ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Dr. Norman Swan of the ABC's Health Report and the podcast What's That Rash joins us tonight. A lot to talk about. If you'd like to talk to him, 1-300-800-222. Norman, good evening to you. Welcome back.
Hi, Phil. Pleasure.
Great to have you with us too. Can we talk about peanut and other nut allergies? I don't know how many conversations I've had with older Australians about the fact that this didn't seem to be around when they were kids, and now it's everywhere. It's the bane of many parents. I've looked after small children, friends of ours, and I've, you know, had the EpiPen left on the kitchen bench just in case. The thinking about it might have changed, has it? There's some good news about peanut allergy. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, because the older generation hasn't experienced it to any great extent, there's been some cynicism, you know, is this all made up? Well, it's very real. Anyone, a child, so the food allergy is the main cause of anaphylaxis, which is the really serious form of allergy where you get blotchy rash, your lips swell, you can have obstructed breathing and so on, really nasty. And peanut allergy is particularly nasty within those food allergies. And people say, oh, you know, they're going overboard and eliminating peanuts from the childcare centre and so on. But, you know, kids who are peanut allergic are really allergic, and they can have a life-threatening allergy. It's not an invention of the parents. So, but it is relatively recent that the increase has been seen over time. And as you correctly say, and the question is why? So people say, oh, it's the food industry. They've been using peanuts a lot in their food, which they never used to before. Some truth to that, but that's almost certainly not the reason. There's a variation in peanut allergy around the world. So the Middle East, Southeast Asia, places where peanuts are much more part of the diet. Hmm. You'd think peanut allergy would be through the roof, but in fact, it's not. This is almost certainly, to a significant extent, a doctor-caused disease.
Okay. What do we mean by that? Because the conversations I've had, and indeed, you know, it's my own anecdotal memory too, is that it just didn't exist. Peanut butter was a very common spread. It was as common as, you know, butter and Vegemite. Peanut butter was very common at school. And there was an issue of allergy was never spoken about, never knew anybody who had it.
So what happened 20, 30 years ago, maybe longer, was that pediatricians started to say, and the breastfeeding industry started to say to parents, mothers particularly, don't give solids before 6 months. And because they fear, and the World Health Organization went down that line as well. And a lot of this was driven by the World Health Organization, by the way, who were frightened that mothers in low-income countries would give up breastfeeding if the child went on to solids. The child would have its appetite slaked by the for solids and didn't want to go on the breast, when breastfeeding would be life-saving in low-income countries, which is true. Turns out that's not true. Early introduction of solids does not put a child off breastfeeding, but that's what the World Health Organization believed. And then some senior allergists, particularly in the United States, said, oh, we need to be careful about how we introduce potentially allergic foods like eggs and fish and peanuts. So you've got to do this really carefully. So late onset of solids, and you've got to be really careful. So just be really tentative about how you give your child peanuts. Now, if you want to make somebody allergic to something, the way you do it is, well, ideally you start in childhood if you want to do this. It sounds as if I'm into child abuse here, but you know what I'm saying is you give small doses repeatedly of the substance to which you're going to become allergic, and your immune system is primed. So the very way they were giving peanuts, eggs, and fish was designed to prime the immune system for allergy. And they were missing an important window in the first 6 months of life when you had a chance to train the immune system to these potentially allergic foods. So you're missing that window and also being frightened of these foods and giving them tentatively after the age of 6 months. And that's what appears to have caused a significant proportion of the epidemic. Then they did studies looking at, one study I remember is a study of Ashkenazi Jewish children in Israel and Ashkenazi Jewish children in London. Same genetic stock. Ashkenazi Jewish children in Israel got a far lower rate of peanut allergy than kids in London, so effectively the same children.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that kids in Israel got bamba, they got peanut mix in their same sort of diet as Arab kids got, a Middle Eastern diet, and they were exposed to peanuts early.
Mm.
And then there was a trial which said, you know, so then they started to tweak, this advice might be wrong. So then they did a trial called the LEAP trial, which reduced the, which introduced these allergenic foods early and introduced solids early and reduced the incidence of peanut allergy by about 80%. So the advice, and then, but pediatricians knew this, but they didn't want to contradict the World Health Organization.
Where did they, where did the erroneous evidence come from in the first place, though? So I said, you know, there seemed to be a generational view that these things didn't exist. I mean, how did the World Health Organization suddenly think that these things did exist?
Well, this was an inadvertent, this is partly inadvertent, because they were focused on breastfeeding in low-income countries to save children, to save babies' lives, which indeed it does. And to some extent, this was a side effect of that delayed onset of solids. And pediatricians here were frightened to, they didn't want to contradict the World Health Organization, but they knew that this is what they should do. So slowly the guidelines changed. And so the guidelines now, they vary from country to country. We say between 4 and 6 months you start to introduce solids, and you should be reasonably relaxed about introducing, even if your child's got a bit of eczema, that you should be reasonably relaxed about introducing peanuts, eggs, fish into the child's diet. You don't become obsessive compulsive about it, but just introduce it the way you would normally. You've got a baby starting solids. You don't start solids before the baby's interested in solids and able to sort of handle it. You don't want a child choking. But when the child's ready for solids, you give them solids and you slowly introduce new foods as time goes on, but not in tiny quantities, just as it goes in terms of a meal. One meal might have fish or eggs or what have you. So what's the paper that's been published in the last week or two is from the United States, where they've tracked a large number of children and they've tracked the allergic antibodies in their allergic antibodies and the symptoms of allergic disease before the guidelines changed in the United States, while the guidelines changed, and after. And what they've shown is, this is real world. So in the LEAP trial that I talked about before was an ideal situation where the diets were monitored and parents were really pushed to follow the rules. So you got an 80% reduction. These were high risk, tended to be high risk children. In this one is real world, all comers. And what they found was a 20-odd% reduction in the risk of any food allergy and about a 35% reduction in the risk of peanut allergy, just following this population of children in the United States through the guidelines. So your intro wasn't, it's not that it's going to go away. Kids are still going to get peanut allergy. There are peanuts, more peanuts in the diet than there were before. Some kids always got peanut allergy. You're not going to get rid of this completely, but it looks as though we can, slowly return to the old days where it was a smaller number of children who got food allergies.
So in other words, introduce solids early when the baby is interested. And a lot of parents adopt, I know, a common sense view that, well, pretty much the baby should be eating what everybody else eats in the house.
That's certainly what you're moving towards. And maybe you and I have talked to this before, but There's some, you know, parents are being conned at the moment, right, with guilt that they should be giving toddler formula to their children once they get to 12 months. And that is just so wrong. And these toddler formulas are unhealthy. They're sweetened. It is not a normal child diet for a toddler. You're right. You're progressing towards eating what the rest of the family eats, and replacing milk with water.
So is it okay? So in general, it would be okay at between four and six months to, if the baby was interested, to, you know, lick some peanut butter off your finger, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not going to give people advice on air, but that's the kind of idea that, and you'd obviously talk it over if you've got a pediatrician or your GP. Talk it over with them, but unless there's a reason not to. But you don't want to go mad introducing solids too early when the child's not ready. But when the child's ready, you should just introduce a relatively normal diet for a baby, and it's got to be mush. You know, they can't chew anything.
A friend of mine's little baby. She sent me a photograph of the baby attacking a lamb chop. Well, the baby was not making much progress, given that it had no teeth.
I mean, I've got it.
I suddenly thought, well, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I mean, the baby was basically just sucking on the lamb chop, but you know, that seemed like not such a bad idea.
Yeah, there's this whole thing about babies, you know, the tactile thing on the high chair, and the child feeling the food and so on. Pediatricians get a bit nervous about that because some parents just start too soon when the child can't swallow and they get this sort of choking fit. But most kids do very well. I mean, I've got a hilarious couple of photographs side by side where my granddaughter, who was then, I don't know, was in a high chair, and this is in the United States, and just eating anything off the high chair. And there must have been blueberries. So the face was blue and there was a mess everywhere. And my wife's niece, same age, but a Vietnamese mother, same age, every piece of food in its place. The child doesn't even have, you know, a bib on because it doesn't make any mess. You know, there are cultural differences to how messy you're prepared to go with the food. But, you know, the child of the Vietnamese mother was certainly getting peanuts or peanut paste.
A couple of people texting in too saying, Is this also what mothers should be doing while pregnant? Because there were warnings that, you know, while pregnant, you shouldn't eat foods that contain egg, chicken, seafood and peanuts because it could affect the fetus. Does this mean, says Eliza, one of my texters, that mothers should eat peanuts during pregnancy and breastfeeding?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, I don't want to give individual advice because everybody's different. But what we're talking about here with babies is what goes inside the gut.
Yeah,
because the gut trains the immune system for the rest of your life, and it's that gut training. So, you know, from what the food that a mother's eating, so certainly a mother can take in toxins which go through the placenta and affect the baby, you know, lead and what have you, not paracetamol, but, you know, a mother can, you can transmit toxins through the bloodstream to the baby, and it can affect the baby's development. Unusual these days, but it can happen. I'm not aware of strong evidence that a mother's diet affects the child's chances of allergies. Mothers should just eat what they feel like eating and what's normal. And it's what happens after birth, and it's what the baby ingests into the gut and trains the gut. That's why breastfeeding is so important, you know, getting antibodies that. And so on. I mean, what the really important thing for mothers to think about is not necessarily what they're eating, but just to make sure they're immunized, for example. So they're immunized against flu and COVID, so those viruses don't get through to the baby. But so what you eat probably makes no difference at all.
Dr. Norman Swan is with us. If you'd like to ask him a question, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Phil, what about honey? Is it still important to avoid in kids under 1 year old? That's not allergy related, is it? Says Alison in Brisbane.
You know, that's the whole pasteurisation thing.
Yeah.
I should know the answer to that, but I don't. So I won't comment. I mean, you certainly want your child to get pasteurised foods. So when they start,
you mean honey is not generally.
I think you can get pasteurized honey. I think that's what you've got to watch, is that there's no infection there. I think that's the story with honey. But you know, and again, you wouldn't give unpasteurized cheese to older toddlers and so on. You've got to protect them.
Mm. Women stayed at home and ate peanut butter sandwiches for lunch. Fresh bread and peanut butter was easy for lunch, says my texter. The baby in utero was exposed to it well before birth. Yeah, true. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Sally says, Phil, to add to the conversation, says Robin, something that my grandparents passed down through the family is that the foods your mother gives you when you're young are your medicine foods to consume when you get older. Yeah, well, maybe that's right.
Well, that's the chicken soup as penicillin theory.
Not on the same topic, but as I say, our questions, you can ask Norman anything you like. But could you please ask Dr. Swan? I'll get to that question in a moment, Troy, because I want to put this question. I'd like to ask a fellow knee osteoarthritis sufferer. That's Dr. Swan. if drinking a lot of carbonated drinks is detrimental to your joints and cartilage in particular, and by a lot I mean 2 liters a day of diet soft drinks and Pepsi Max.
So we looked at this in our podcast, What's That Rash, about carbonated drinks. So look, you don't want to be drinking sugary drinks. Okay, now, so you're saying Pepsi Max, which means, you know, zero calories.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an ultra-processed food and with all sorts of stuff in it, caramelized chemicals, which are not necessarily good for you. There's the whole debate about artificial sweeteners, which is probably overstated. So for a different reason and nothing to do with your joints, you just want to stay away from those, you know, soft drinks. We looked at this issue of carbonated, you know, water, for example. Does bubbly water make any difference to your joints? And the answer is no.
There's no.
And so you can relax there. Lots of other things you can blame your knee osteoarthritis on, but probably not your drinks.
What about lactose intolerance? There's a couple of texters here. Is this in the same basket as peanut allergies?
No. No.
Is lactose intolerance on the rise? It seems to be.
Well, I think it's been better recognized, particularly in older people.
Mm-hmm.
So kids can get lactose intolerant. So lactose obviously is one of the sugars in milk and dairy, and it's metabolized. It's broken down by an enzyme called lactase in the surface lining of the bowel. Mm. And if a child gets a severe bout of gastroenteritis, that surface gets wiped away and the child can lose their lactase for a few days till that grows back. It grows back quite quickly. So you get lactose intolerance from gastroenteritis. Some people have a genetic lack of lactose. And some people, as they get older, the surface lining of their bowel stops producing lactose with the degree of efficiency of earlier years. And it produces a variety of symptoms that are quite wide. So it can produce wind, bloating, nausea, and sometimes even reflux can be a sign, you know, where you get the acid into the throat and, you know, heartburn. That can be a sign of lactose intolerance.
Hmm.
Now, I always, when I'm talking about lactose intolerance, I always preface this by saying, if you're, you remember I did that Four Corners in early July on early onset cancer.
Hmm.
If at any age you get a new symptom that you've never had before, you've got to go and see your GP and get it sorted out. You know, almost certainly it's nothing at all, but new symptoms need to get sorted out. A headache that you've never had before, tummy ache or bloating or that sort of symptom that you've never had before, go and see your doctor to get checked out. And if your doctor says too young to get cancer, you'll say, well, that's just simply not true because there's this rise in early onset cancers of various kinds. So that's the first thing to say. So having said that, you can get those symptoms with lactose intolerance, things like reflux as a new symptom when you're maybe 45 probably means that you need to have an endoscopy just to check there's nothing untoward happening in your esophagus, because you wouldn't want to miss early malignant changes in your esophagus because you think it's lactose intolerance. You want to get it checked out. Having said that, you can get all these symptoms, and they're easy to treat. So again, you would get the symptoms sorted out and investigated. But if you've got lactose or you want to test it out, there you can buy it in your pharmacy. You can buy lactase supplements, in a sense, which you take just before you eat dairy. And they're great. They work really well.
Mm. Okay, 1-300-800-222. Dr. Norman Swan is with us. Sarah from Mount Macedon. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hello. I was just going to say, I've got terrible gut issues and whatnot, but my son, who's now 15, he just is, like, I could count on two hands the days he's at off school. And he just, when he was born, he didn't get washed.
Mm-hmm.
He, I think they just thought I had a birth plan, and, you know, so I just woke up in the ward and he was covered in muck on my stomach, and it wasn't completely what I'd asked for, but that's what they thought. And he never gets sick. He's like amazing. And the only days he's had off were for probably mental health. And is that something that you think there's some evidence around?
Is that was a vaginal birth, I presume, Sarah, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, Norman, is this still a thing? I mean, this was a thing around for a while, wasn't it, that vaginal birth led to greater immune resilience than cesarean births?
Yeah, it's a thing. The baby does not acquire, when a baby's born with a cesarean section, doesn't acquire the microbiome of the mother's vagina going through. Now, the baby does acquire a microbiome quite quickly after a cesarean section, but it may not be quite what it would have picked up during a vaginal birth. Now, going back to that Four Corners that I did in early July, which people can still find online on early onset cancer, so there's about 10 different cancers that are rising in people with the ages between 30 and 40. It's not just colon cancer. And when you look at what's changed in the world, so if you get, say, colon cancer or pancreas cancer or prostate cancer when you're 30, the numbers aren't high, by the way, but they're rising. It's not because of something that happened when you were 25. It's because of something. Cancer takes a long time to develop. So it's something that happened in childhood or indeed your mother's pregnancy. So you've got to go back to the 70s and 80s to see what changed. And what changed was the growth in the consumption, of ultra-processed foods. And indeed, ultra-processed foods look as though they're one of the reasons why people in their 30s are developing colorectal cancer. Plastics use has gone up hugely in those years, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show, microplastics. And vaginal and cesarean sections rocketed during those years, went from about 13 or 14% in some places, in some hospitals in Australia. At some points, it's been up to 50% women delivered by cesarean section because the obstetrician wants a safe delivery, all sorts of reasons for it, social reasons and others. And the theory that, if that's one of the factors, what could be the story there? Well, it could be the microbiome, that the child's immune system isn't trained as well as it might. Now, if a woman really needs a cesarean section, that's fine, because it's always a balance of risk versus benefit. If the baby's going to die unless it has an emergency caesar, obviously you do it and you don't think twice about it. But for social reasons or too posh to push, I mean, I'm stigmatizing this now, then, have it vaginally.
Mm. Yep, 1300 800. Thanks, Sarah. 1300 800 222 is the number. My texter says nuts grow on trees. Peanuts are not nuts; they are legumes. Oh, well, there you go. Louise from Adelaide. Hello, Louise.
Hi. How are you going?
I'm going well, thank you. What's up?
So I was ringing up. We were at a long lunch at the weekend, which was really nice.
Very good.
But out of
before
the
89... Before you go on, Louise, where are you from? Whereabouts in Glasgow?
Well, your accent's actually the reason I rang in.
Because
I'm like, oh, somebody from Scotland. I am actually from Dumfries and Galloway, so a couple hours south.
Okay.
But I did uni in Glasgow.
Okay, we've got that sorted out.
You two all right now?
That's right. Yeah, we're fine. We've bonded.
And it was actually funny at this winery at the weekend. Our waiter was from Lockerbie, so that was pretty cool as well. But anyway, we sat down to have lunch. There was 89 of us having this long lunch, and there was one celiac out of the whole thing. And I said to my husband, isn't that amazing? He goes, nah, because everybody here's old. Like, we were like basically everybody at the winery would have been late 40s, probably near the 70 age group, and there was hardly any dietary requirements. So then that led us into the discussion of why is that? And what you mentioned before with microplastics and ultra-processed foods were the only things I sort of knew of. So I was really interested tonight to hear about the early feeding of babies, because when I had my kids, I had my daughter in Scotland 20 years ago, and I was told 4 months, introduce feeds. 2 years later, when I had my son in Australia, we were told 6 months. So it changed quite a bit then.
Yeah, this is what, I think it's what you've been saying, Norman. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but what you're talking about there with your lunch, your big lunch, is the one person says they're celiac. So celiac disease hasn't changed really, as far as I'm aware of the statistics. So it's an autoimmune disease where your body reacts to the gluten in your diet. It's important to diagnose it because there's a rare but real risk of malignancy in the bowel. As part of this, you can get lymphoma in the bowel as a result of uncontrolled celiac disease. But then, I mean, I remember I did a food session at the Sydney Writers Festival, and there was about 900 people in the audience, and I asked people to put up their hand if they were if they were on a gluten-free diet, because gluten is the culprit in celiac disease. And like, you know, a third of the audience at least put their hands up. When I think I can't pluck the incidence of celiac disease out of my head, but it's tiny. It was like 3-4%. It's this very, very small percentage of the population of celiac disease. So the 30% put up their hands. So there's this phenomenon called gluten sensitivity. And in fact, we're going to cover it on this week's health report. Is gluten sensitivity. So that there might be. So that's real too. Where you're not. It's not an allergy, it's not an immune thing, it's not celiac disease, but some people get symptoms when they take gluten in their diet, and it's probably a chemical thing, you know, a chemical response. And that's probably about 15% of the population have true gluten sensitivity when you do a double-blind challenge. But it's not 30%. And I think that there's, it's controversial. Again, I'm going to potentially stigmatize some people, but some people who think they've got gluten sensitivity don't have it. So they don't have celiac, they don't have gluten sensitivity, because when you blind them, they actually don't respond any particularly adversely. And, and they go on gluten free. It's much easier to go on a gluten-free diet than it used to be because there's more foods available for it. But, you know, they eventually find that if they eat some gluten without knowing it, they're fine, and they eventually slip off it. So that's more of a kind of a faddish thing associated with an increased awareness that people can react to gluten but without having celiac disease, but it's still not a huge percentage of people.
Okay. Thanks, Louise. Good on you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Appreciate it. 1-300-800-222. Line's free if you want to grab one. We're talking to Dr. Norman Swan. You did a great story on the ABC TV last week about microplastics. Now, we've done a couple of programs about the topic here on Nightlife, one about microplastics in the ocean, which most people, I think, are aware of. But last week we did a program about microplastics in the soil, which I think less people are aware of. I mean, there are common beliefs around, aren't there, as to, you know, there's an urban myth was doing around you, we eat a credit card amount of plastic every week or every month.
Yeah.
And the short answer appears to be that we don't really know, but there's an awful lot of plastic in the environment and we are ingesting it, aren't we? What does it do to us?
Yeah, so let's just dispel the credit card myth. That actually was published in a scientific paper that we're consuming so much plastic, it's the equivalent of a credit card a week or a month or something like that.
Yeah.
And they got their numbers wrong in that paper by an enormous factor. Like to eat, you know, to consume a credit card worth of plastic would take you an enormous length of time, not a week. Mm. So that was out by so far. It's just been utterly discredited. But we do consume some in our diet. The problem is we don't know enough about this. So there's circumstantial evidence. So there are animal studies so what we're talking about here are, so regular listeners tonight will know that it's particles under 5 millimeters, but they can go down to molecular size, nanoplastics, and it's just the wearing away of plastics in the environment, but also in the home as well. Mm. And nanoplastics, the worry is that you can absorb them. They're so small, you can absorb them from your gut, absorb them from your lungs, and absorb them from your skin if they're in cosmetics. Now, there have been studies in animals suggesting that it can affect brain inflammation. There have been studies, postmortem studies in humans where they look at, and they're not well done, they're not well conducted studies. So where you look at the brains of people who've died of dementia versus people who haven't, and they claim to have found more plastic in the microplastics in the brains of people who've died of dementia. Similarly, with heart attacks. Now, those are not well-conducted studies. They're not reliable. But equally, on the other side of the equation, there's about 16,000 chemicals go into plastics of various kinds. And of those 16,000 chemicals, this is work done internationally, also partly by the Mindaroo Foundation in Western Australia. Andrew Forrest is very interested in this topic, is of those 16,000 plastics, chemicals in plastics, those are additives, contaminants, and substances that make the plastic itself, only a third have been tested for safety to some extent, mm-hmm. and almost none for human safety. And those who have been, of the third that have been tested, 75% of those show some evidence of harm. Now, that doesn't mean that the rest of the 16,000 or 10,000 or whatever are harmful. We simply don't know, and they're poorly regulated. We simply don't know which plastics are safe and which might be harmful. So bottom line here is there could be a problem here with microplastics in human health. We don't know. And the question is, how long do you wait to find out?
Yeah. Well, exactly.
And that's what panics people. So last week's story on 7:30, we went to somebody's house in Blacktown and we surveyed and we measured airborne and floor-borne, if you like, plastic particles and discovered quite a lot. The children's play area was a lot of plastic, mm-hmm. as you can imagine. And we couldn't measure how much they might have been consuming in their food. It's very hard to buy food at the supermarket that's not surrounded in plastic.
Well, this is the whole argument about plastic, isn't it? You can't actually avoid it. I mean, it's not as though you could adopt a strategy in life saying, I won't have any contact with, consume, use, or otherwise be associated with plastic. It's not possible in the modern world.
It's not. So what the experts say is, you can either do nothing, or if you're worried about it, do what you can. So, and I've looked at this area and I've researched, I've done various programs like you have. So I'll tell you what I've done in my own life is I've not panicked about it, but I don't wrap food in plastic anymore. I got rid of non-stick cookware because it's got forever chemicals on it and you get scratched, you've no idea what you're consuming. There are no plastic cooking utensils, so scrapers and stuff like that. Spoons, those have gone because they get frayed very easily in the heat. So heat, what they do know is that heat is bad for plastic, and you're talking about microplastics. So if you microwave plastic, it's certainly a complete no-no to do it on single-use plastic. But if you microwave plastic, you are going to damage the plastic and some microplastics will spin off. They've shown in dishwashing that dishwashing plastics can produce a shower of microplastics, which might stick to other dishes and so on in the microwave. So I don't heat plastic. I don't dishwash. Plastic can be a bit of a pain in the neck if there was grease on the plastic. There are various hacks that you can use to get rid of the grease on plastic. And so no non-stick cookware, got changed over to cast iron and stainless steel. I mean, this is expensive to do. And you can't do it suddenly. And then eliminating plastic containers, that's much harder. You know, we've got two teenage boys in the house. You can't send a kid to school with a glass container. There are metal ones around. So you do what you can and not panic. And you're not going to throw out all your kids' Lego. And what the expert that we had in the program was suggesting is that you don't do that with your kids, but you vacuum daily so that the area where they're playing with their toys, the plastic particles on the floor are vacuumed up. And you're probably going to minimize the exposure that way. So you do what you can without going nuts.
Linda says, what about babies' dummies? They're plastic.
Well, they're silicon, and some people argue that silicon is much more inert and a much safer form of, if you want to call it, a plastic. It's a much simpler chemical structure, and much more inert. So, people argue that silicon is okay. And the thing is,
babies spent much of their life sucking on plastic things, as we know.
Yeah, and they've always had dummies. In the old days, they were rubber dummies. They weren't plastic. Mm. And rubber's probably much worse for you than a silicon dummy.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Ron from Berwick. G'day, Ron.
Yeah, hello. How are you going?
Yeah, good.
Good. Look, I've just wanted to ask a question of Dr. Swan. I'm 74 now, and about 2 or 3 years ago, I was diagnosed as being a celiac, having a gluten intolerance. And I sort of tried it for the first 12 months or so and didn't have much success, and then I went off it completely. Now I've gone back on it again on that gluten-free diet, as much as I can anyway. But I've also got another condition, though. It's an autoimmune condition, but I think Dr. Son was saying it's not anything to do with autoimmunity, is it?
Yes, it is. Celiac disease is an autoimmune disease and often goes with other autoimmune diseases.
I got that mixed up then, because I've got another condition which I've had for 6 or 7 years, which is warm hemolytic anemia.
Right.
Which no one sort of seems to have heard of. But
warm hemolytic anemia.
Warm hemolytic anemia, yeah. It's the white blood cells attack the red blood cells.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm on, I mean, I've had very treatment for that for years and it's stabilised and I'm okay, but I'm just wondering if this might have triggered something else, you know, in that area.
I can't give you advice for your own situation. What I do know is that when they've studied people with celiac disease, which clearly you've got, it's gluten intolerance, and you really should try to stick to your diet because you don't want that damage to the bowel, is that often other autoimmune diseases emerge. And that's probably just that you've got a genetic susceptibility to autoimmune disease rather than the celiac or the gluten causing your hemolytic anemia.
That sort of came out of nowhere. Just sort of happened.
Yeah, I think they're just partners in crime rather than one causing the other.
Okay, thanks, Ron. 1-300-800-222. Latif says, "What are the coatings on frying pans?" Well, look, yeah, we have covered this before, and I'm sure you'd agree, Norman. Avoid them. Don't buy cooking utensils with non-stick coatings.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is I say again, they are expensive when you buy cast iron and so on, but it is actually a revelation cooking on cast iron, seasoned cast iron. You can scrub them to their heart's content, and they just love being scrubbed. You know, they don't, you're not going to harm them. And you know, and if you do something like a fried egg on it, you can do it at a very careful heat. They're a pleasure to cook with, actually.
Yes, they are, and there are some. We won't name brands here, of course, and on the ABC, but there are some good Australian brands actually of cast iron and iron.
Yeah, I've got Australian, and they're excellent, and they've got an international reputation.
Yeah, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Michael says, before I ask that question, we'll just take Trevor's call from Claire, also about celiacs. Trevor, hello.
Yes, hello there. Yeah, I was going to make a comment about that, but if I can first ask the doctor a question. I have a grandchildren, 3.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. Is it too? Unfortunately, they've gone against everything you've said and gone by the book, and kept them off solids for 6 months, much to our angst. Mm-hmm. And is it too late now? Is there certain strategies they can do to try and help get back to where they probably should have been? And following that up, because with both of the children, the mother had been put on strict diets, trying to sort out what was going on with the infant's gut, and she's still doing that with the second child, and. We just reckon that they just need to feed the kid and get back to normal, eat a normal diet, and you'll probably be right. You know, I know you can't give specific advice, but can they? Is there some sort of way that she could perhaps try and help recover the situation?
Well, it depends whether the child's developed a food allergy or not. But the child's not got a food allergy. You just move the child progressively in the second 6 months of life, as Phil and I were talking about earlier, onto a modified version of an adult diet, and not worry about what they're eating, and you wind down the milk so that by the time they're 12 months, milk's not an important part of their diet. It's water, and they're getting most of their nourishment from food. And you just keep on giving. You got to offer a child, you know, some children will take to green vegetables with alacrity, but they say you got to offer a child broccoli 20 times before they start eating it. You just got to leave it on the table there. But just move towards progressively towards an adult diet and not get too anxious about it. They've already got a food allergy. It's a different story. But there is this issue that parents get very troubled by, and I think pediatricians get troubled by as well, which is that between about 6 and 12, maybe 14 weeks, babies' crying rate go up. It's kind of a normal thing, and it's actually worse in breastfed babies than in bottle-fed babies. So this is not an anti-breast feeding comment I'm about to make. It's just a statement of fact. So you go through this crying period, and so you turn up at the pediatrician, and the pediatrician might say, oh, well, I think, you know, there's a bit of food intolerance going on here, and they change the milk to progressively to maybe a rice formula and so on, and they fiddle around with the diet, and then it tends to go away 12, 14 weeks. And everybody plats themselves on the back. And often they've had an antacid given to them as well, which is against the medical guidelines, by the way. But a lot of young babies are on what these call protein pump inhibitors. And that's against the guidelines. But they're used widely. And parents swear by it. They say, oh, it really is making a difference. And you've got to say, well, maybe that's true. Sometimes going off the breast and going into a bottle fixes the problem. But then you get this persistent issue that I've got a child with a disrupted bowel, which you don't really. It's just you've had that rough trot, and you do tend to come through the other end. But in terms of your original question, sorry, it's taking me so long to get to the point. If it's starting to get solids after 6 months, of course it's retrievable. You can just give them progressively a normal diet and not restrict them.
Yep. Certainly, well, she's 7 months old now. Certainly, they've treated this child a little bit differently, and they're cranking up the solids. And also, this child also has much more appetite, so she'll just go for anything. So she's having plenty of soft pumpkin, and you can give her a chopped bone to suck on, and all that sort of thing. So she's into all of that.
It's the old story. You want to be the second child,
The first. For all sorts of reasons.
All the neuroses.
Yeah. All right, Trev. Thanks, mate. Good luck with it. 1-300-800-222. My texter says sometime between 1970 and 1980. The Mike Walsh Show had a guest advocating chewing cling wrap as a substitute for flossing your teeth. Dear idea. Yes, well, times have changed in lots of ways. That is for sure. 1-300-800-222. Oh, here's a question someone wanted to ask you on the text line in particular. I heard Dr. Swan mention recently the shingles vaccine was possibly beneficial for dementia. As a 53-year-old and having a father with dementia, is it worth the $600 to buy two shots of the vaccine, says Mike in Perth?
Here's the evidence. Mm-hmm. And the evidence is in older people.
Right.
And there's now several studies which show that the older people who get, because it tends to be older people who get the shingles vaccine, there was a fascinating study in Wales where they introduced the shingles vaccine, I think, to people aged 70, and there was a date where it changed over. And the people who took the shingles vaccine on the date that it changed over, so it was like a natural trial, they had about a 17% reduced risk of dementia following the vaccine. And there have been other studies elsewhere, much larger studies, more reliable studies, which confirm that finding, that the shingles vaccine. Now, there's this tantalizing other evidence suggesting that it's not just the shingles vaccine in older life. There are other vaccines, perhaps even the influenza vaccine, that might be associated with reduced risk of dementia, which makes people think that maybe, you know, and you now come to RFK Jr. in the United States, who wants to remove all additives from vaccines, that it may be that the additives in the vaccine are actually doing something to the immune system, which can affect the deposition of these chemicals in the brain, which seem to produce dementia. So it looks as if it might be any vaccine, but certainly shingles. And then more recently, in the last week or two, there's a suggestion that shingles vaccine might also reduce the risk of coronary heart disease, heart attacks and strokes. A word of warning, that was a study that hasn't been properly published yet and was also sponsored by the company that produces the shingles vaccine. So take that with a grain of salt.
Okay.
So coming back to your 53, I suppose you've just got to make the decision for yourself. You're not going to come to any harm by having the shingles vaccine, apart from the $600, which you're going to spend there. And, you know, if dementia is running in your family, there's no proof that it's going to make a difference if you've got a strong genetic cause of dementia. But why wouldn't you do it if you can afford the vaccine?
Mm. Yeah, indeed. Well, indeed. 1-300-800-222. What about this one? About 20% of people are wearing false teeth and are exposed to 36 degrees while in the mouth. There they are depositing microplastics when they're worn. A problem?
Well, yes. As I said, the evidence for harm has not been booked yet, definitely. And there will be plastics which are safer than others. And the people who look at this area, particularly the Mindaroo Foundation, say if you had better regulation, you'd know which plastics you don't need to worry about and which you do need to worry about. But they're so poorly regulated, it doesn't help consumers make choices.
Mm. All right. Norman, it's been terrific. But as usual, when we're having an informative discussion with you, we have run out of time to take it further. But thanks for your time. And if you'd like to know more, you can always find Norman at the ABC's Health Report and his podcast, What's That Rash? Norman, good stuff. Thank you.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure, Phil.
Dr. Norman Swan. And thank you for all the questions, too. If you want to follow some of this up, as I say, then get hold of Norman at the ABC's Health Report. We'll have Norman back on a fairly regular basis, and we'll get him back further down the track.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.